We often treat the story we're looking at today of the walls of Jericho as one of those good old Sunday school stories. One of those stories where it sounds like, in a sense, there's a lot of fun or something. But actually, it's a deeply uncomfortable story. And I'm hugely aware of the irony of looking at this story, having listened to Carlin talking about peace building. And how does the God who calls us to build peace allow, or even more than allow, what happened at Jericho? We'll unpick some of that as we go through this passage. But how do you prepare for the battle that was coming? I don't know if you remember, about 15 years ago, before Iraq was unfolding, the words of Colonel Tim Collins, before his regiment went into battle. Here's something of what he said, talking about his enemies. Show respect for them. There are some who are alive at this moment who will not be alive shortly. Those who do not wish to go on that journey, we will not send. As for the others, I expect you to rock their world. Wipe them out as if that is what they choose. But if you're ferocious in battle, remember to be magnanimous in victory. Iraq is steeped in history. It's the site of the Garden of Eden, of the Great Flood, and the birthplace of Abraham. Tread lightly there. You will see things that no man could pay to see, and you will have to go a long way to find a more decent, generous, and upright people than the Iraqis. You will be embarrassed by their hospitality, even though they have nothing. Don't treat them as refugees, for they're there in their own country. Their children will be poor. In years to come, they will know that the light of liberation in their lives was brought by you. If they are casualties of war, then remember when they woke up and got dressed in the morning, they did not plan to die this day. Allow them dignity in death. Bury them properly and mark their graves. It is my foremost intention to bring every single one of you out alive. But there may be people among us who will not see the end of this campaign. We will put them in their sleeping bags and send them back. There will be no time for sorrow. The enemy should be in no doubt that we are his nemesis and that we are bringing about his rightful destruction. And so it went on. And there were words that went viral as they were picked up. And they brought together lots of the discomfort that we feel about battle, while in the same time, that sense of courage that people were going to take on something. How did the people feel as they prepared to go into Jericho? We have looked at this over the last few weeks. And we have thought about that fear and that sense of this is too big for us. But now the time has come and they have to do what God's called them to do. In part that we didn't read at the beginning of Joshua chapter 5, a religious ritual takes place where all of the men are to be circumcised because this generation of Israelites are a new generation. These weren't the people who had come out of Egypt. These were a new people. And then they are told to get themselves ready. God has a big job for them. Let's, in a sense, park for a moment what that job was. And just think in general terms that if God calls us to do a job, we have to be in right relationship with him. That's the starting point. And so the people were given instructions about how the ark was to be carried. They were given instructions about the rituals that were to be carried out. Not because of the value of the rituals themselves, but because when God calls us to do a job, the first and most fundamental requirement is that our relationship with him is as it should be. And so Joshua was commissioned by God. This mysterious man appeared to him. And it becomes clear as it unfolds that this was a messenger from the Lord, giving Joshua his instructions, encouraging Joshua, but also, in a sense, reminding him that he was Moses' appointed successor. You see the words. Joshua's told, take off your sandals. You're in holy ground. And if you're thinking in biblical terms, that takes you back to Moses and the burning bush, where Moses was told, take off your sandals because you're in holy ground. In other words, Joshua was being told, this is not your job. This is my job. You're my servant. I've equipped you for the job. And so Joshua is sent out to do a job. And there's a sense that whatever we do, in whatever sphere of life, we have to have that sense of being commissioned by God. Here am I, send me. Send me where? Well, it could be into Jericho, it could be into Croatia, but it could be into the office tomorrow. It could be into that tricky situation, that tricky family situation, that slightly awe-inspiring, in the wrong sense of the word, medical appointment. Commissioned by God, sent by God. In other words, I'm going with you, God says. I'm not sending you alone. And so Joshua and the army are commissioned, and then they're sent using God's method. And it seems positively bizarre, doesn't it? All this marching round Jericho. How they must have laughed. How their enemies must have laughed. What? We just march round, and then when the time comes, some trumpets blow, and the walls collapse. God's methods seem positively bizarre. And yet this is where faith and works come together. Faith is saying, I believe in a God who is bigger than me. But when the rubber hits the road, it's when works come into play. You see, faith and works are not two opposites, but they belong together. You can only show your faith by the things that you do. So the people showed their faith by obedience to God. And we are called to show our faith by obedience to Him. To do what He tells us to do in the way He tells us to do it. And what God calls us to believe and sometimes to do will at times seem stupid. Maybe to us, maybe to the world around us. Just as those people must have seemed crazy to the people marching around as they marched around the city. And yet, that's what we're called to do. Because we keep faith gladly. That's what God calls us to do. And sometimes it is those big things, and sometimes it's the everyday. In our workplace, or in our home. One of the books I've been reading this week is a little booklet published by LICC, which tells the story of 8 people in their workplaces. And one of the stories that struck me was the story of a woman called Ruth. And Ruth's job is to negotiate training packages on behalf of her company. She's a trainer. And every day, like a lot of us, she prayed. She prays before she goes to her work. And one day as she was praying, she got this sense that actually God was saying something specific to her about a contract that she was going to negotiate. And her usual method of operation was to go in and the kind of the employer would state a figure, she would state a figure, they would negotiate it, and they would find a way to the right package. And one day, she got this sense about this big job that was coming up, and she was being told, don't name a figure. And to her, that just seemed positively bizarre, because that wasn't the way she worked. She got a call then from a senior trainer who'd been negotiating with the same company. And this senior trainer said, I've got a really good deal. They're buying my services and my part of the package, and it's a really good price. And Ruth thought, great. It makes no sense to go in and not name a figure. But anyway, she went into the meeting, and the negotiator and herself started chatting. And as they did so, they started talking about the package and so on. And the negotiator said, and what kind of figure would you be looking for? And Ruth said to him, well, what would you be in a position to pay? And he said, I'm really glad you've asked that question, because I've had somebody in within the past few days that we gave the deal to, but we believe that they asked for a very high price. Now, you've got a good record with us, and we have got a really big deal coming up outside of this one. And because of your record, and because you haven't tried to sting us for everything that we have, I'm going to put you down as a preferred bidder for this contract. And Ruth said that she learned from that. She learned in terms of her employment. And the lesson that she learned was, when negotiating, try and put yourself in the other person's position. Not just what are you trying to get out of it for yourself, but how does it seem from their side of the table? God's method. God's ways. Sometimes seems surprising. Sometimes positively bizarre. And we may not go into Jericho situations, but there will be times when God says to us, and we have that sense of, I'm telling you to do something unusual. Trust me here. Take me at my word. Just go with it. And that's part of what faith is. It's saying, God knows better than me. His ways are better than mine. In the everyday and in the big stuff. But then we come to the difficulty. The difficulty with this passage. And that's, I believe it's one of the reasons why when I was trawling the internet, one of my preparation methods is to read what other people have said and think about what they have said and then kind of think, oh, there's a useful point. And very few people seem to preach in this passage. It's fine for Sunday school kids. We'll teach them about slaughtering people in Jericho. But we'll not do it the grown-up way. Because it is difficult. And I'm not going to pretend that there is an easy answer when we go from here. But let's at least address the difficulties. There's a cartoon which has all of the people lined up outside Jericho and one saying to another, what would Jesus do? And that, in a sense, encapsulates our difficulty, because we're saying, hang on, this God seems so different from the Jesus that we present. Let's address it first in Old Testament terms. Remember that what's happening here goes back centuries in the Bible story. Abraham had been told to go from his own land and had been promised a land that God would give him. And when God was promising Abraham this land, he said to him that he would inherit land, but he wouldn't do so for several generations. In the fourth generation, he is told, when the iniquity of the Amorites is complete. So you have a sense there that actually the people that were inside Jericho were being allowed or being permitted to live with the consequences of their own choices. In Deuteronomy chapter 9, 4 and 5, in similar terms, we read, "After the Lord your God has driven them out before you, do not say to yourself, 'The Lord has brought me here to take possession of this land because of my righteousness.' No, it's an account of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is going to drive them out before you. It's not because of your righteousness or your integrity that you are going to take possession of their land, but on account of the wickedness of these nations. The Lord your God will drive them out before you to accomplish what he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Remember back to the words of Colonel Tim Collins that we started with. And one of the things that he said to soldiers, one of those things that I suspect makes you feel uncomfortable as it did me, wipe them out if they choose. What's that about? Ultimately, it's about free will. And it's about people making choices that deliberately reject God. The Bible's ultimate definition of wickedness is ungodliness. And there is the sense that in Jericho, there was a place where every restraint had been thrown off. When you read some of the histories, they positively make the hairs on your neck stand on end because of some of the stuff that was going on. And there's a sense of judgment there. Aldous Huxley, the writer, said, "A man's worst difficulties begin when he is able to do what he likes." And you see, standing by itself without any restraint, freedom quickly becomes license, and license ultimately becomes the enemy of freedom. If you think that through, that thing, "I can do what I want." Well, when we do what we want, without placing any restraints on ourselves, we damage people round about us. "I can do what I want." No, I can't, if it damages the person next to me. And so what we have here is, in Old Testament terms, the judgment of God. That doesn't answer all of our difficulties, but at least I hope it gives you a sense of what is going on here. That God is judging a people, and he is using Joshua and the Israelites to restore order, to bring some sort of justice. How does that affect us? Does that mean that we can be involved in genocide? Absolutely not. Because Scripture then tells us that it is the Lord who is judge. It's not us who does the judging. And so we have to hold these things together. That God will judge, that sometimes he will use people, situations, as an instrument of his judgment. But it's his job, and it's not our job to pronounce and say, "Aha, look at them. They're getting what they deserve, because God's bringing it on them." That's not our place. God is bigger than us. A few weeks ago, I went to a meeting that a colleague had called together of people who have more than 10 years left in ministry. And the meeting was, what will the church look like in 10 years' time? We didn't have a crystal ball, and I'm still not sure what the answer is. But one of the things that was said that struck me at that meeting was, I'm not sure whether the times that we live in just now are an opportunity or a judgment for the church. And only God can know that. And what's our job? Our job is to be faithful to be faithful to all of God's word, to be faithful in obedience in every aspect. And so Joshua and the army went in and the walls came tumbling down. But then we return to the story of Rahab. And it's no accident that we return to the story of Rahab. Remember, Rahab was the prostitute who had rescued the spies or got the spies away whenever they came into the land. And they had made a deal that they would look after her and her family. And sure enough, they did. And at the time we looked at that story, we noted that in a sense it was almost a side road off the main road of the story. The story of Rahab wasn't integral to the whole plot, or at least it didn't seem to be. Because the big story was the people coming to take the land. Where did Rahab fit in? Surely that's a diversion. And we see now that actually it was no diversion. Because it's showing that even in context of judgment, there is always mercy available. And it's showing that God wasn't choosing for himself a race, but God was choosing for himself a people. And anyone could belong to that people, as Rahab chose to. And so it's saying that on the one hand, we have a God of mercy, but that same God is a God of judgment. And those two things can't be pulled apart, because there are times when justice needs to be done. We know that situation or that person who just need to be stopped somehow. But we also know that situation, that person who needs to be offered a chance, because they will take that chance. And so that's what Rahab tells us, that there is always an escape if we listen to the voice of God. It's when we shut out the voice of God that there is no escape. And so the story of the walls of Jericho is not some fun Sunday school pageant, but it's a difficult story with prickly bits round about it that I can't pretend that we can smooth away. And the answers aren't comfortable. And there's not a package that I can go out and say, yes, this is how we make it acceptable. But ultimately we have to say it's about a God who is big, and a God who has the right to judge, but a God who in the context of that shows mercy. And the name Joshua can be translated Jesus. And as is often the case in the Old Testament, what we have here is a pointer towards Jesus, the rescuer. And if you think about Jesus, the rescuer, what did Jesus say about himself? Well, he said that he had come to bring mercy, and he also said he had come to bring judgment. And how we respond to him is the ultimate determinant of mercy or judgment. And it's God's methods, not ours. In many ways, the gospel doesn't make sense. It's not the way we would choose. Tim Keller puts it this way: the gospel, by telling us that our salvation is free and undeserved, is really insulting. It tells us that we are such spiritual failures, that the only way for us to gain salvation is for it to be a complete gift. This offends moral and religious people who think their decency gives them an advantage over less moral people. And that's why the story of Rahab is there. It's to shake us out of our respectability, to shake us out of our I deserve it mentality, and to say, actually, what we need from God is mercy. And he is willing to give mercy to all who come to him. Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest, said Jesus. But that first requires an acknowledgement of our weariness, of our heavy loads, and our inability to deal with them ourselves. And it says, okay, Lord, do it your way. Do it your way, because you are the all-powerful God, the God who's much bigger than we are, whose methods aren't always comfortable for us, but the God who says, come, come through Jesus. Let's pray together. Lord our God, we come and we confess that we do not find you a comfortable God. And neither we should, because you are holy and you are just, while our understanding is limited and corrupted. But we thank you that we can come to you through Jesus, the one who is the rescuer, the one who came to offer life. Help us to live by your methods.